So, good morning everyone. My name is Vic Prasanna, or it's Derek Smith, depending on whether you come to my yoga classes or things here. I don't use my Buddhist name in the yoga world so much. I'll tell you why later if you like, but I'm either name. I don't mind what you call me out of those two. As you can see from the sheet there, we've got eight little sections of the day. The first one of which is now a few introductions. I started doing yoga in 1978 when my wife said, would I go with her to give a Dutch courage to her first yoga class? So we duly went. She hated it, I loved it. So that was a strange beginning, and I haven't stopped doing it since, although it certainly has, since I moved to Norwich in 1986, it's certainly gone up, up and up in my life. As for Buddhism, I think I've always been into Buddhism without really knowing it, but formally, I suppose I first got involved about 1988, so I've been a long time in both traditions. At first, we so-called Buddhist yogis would almost practice clandestinely, trying to convince others that the two are okay together, honestly. And that's the subject we've got today, so it interests me. So that's me, basically, a foot in both camps. It's a vast subject we've taken on here, and we've got 5 hours to explore two massive traditions, which of course is impossible. And what I'm therefore trying to do is weave a path through them that I'm assuming something that we'll find out in a minute, that some of you who perhaps are into the yoga world might find your first steps into the Buddhist world, or vice versa. But also so that we can compare, find some crossovers between the two practices. And I don't mind if we disagree at the end whether yoga and Buddhism are compatible. In fact, I rather hope we don't agree, actually, and it would be much more interesting. But that's the sort of area that I want to try and sort of get into today. I'll make no bones about it. As time rolls on, I think the two practices, sets of practices, are more compatible than I ever thought they were. But there are some deep differences that we'll perhaps touch on. So I'm going to be interested today. I want you to inspire me and trigger my thoughts on this subject and disagree with me as often as you like to. We're going to look at lists and talk about ideas and come up with models and maps for Buddhism, for yoga. That's all they are, models and maps. Then there is the direct experience that you have on the yoga mat, on the meditation cushion. That's a different thing. Think of it like this. There's the map and there's the territory. If you've got your OS map and you decide you're going to go out for a walk on the North Norfolk coast, some people might look at the weather and think, no, it's going to rain. I'll just look all over the map. Look at those places that you'd walk past if you did this. That's the map. Going out without a map, but just on the land, is the real experience, the direct experience. Apply that to what we do. We can sit on that meditation cushion and go through a list and think we've meditated. We haven't. The best meditation is where you put those lists aside and whatever happens to you happens in its own terms. You know, it's a direct experience. And I've got a feeling, and I've been guilty of it, that a lot of people don't have a direct experience. They have a playing out of a list or a playing. It's all in their heads, in other words. Does that sort of make sense? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah? We have constant arguments with a particular friend of mine in Buddhism who knows every list there is very, very well. And he sort of says, well, I meditated such and such a style today, and of course in that style this happens and that happens. And we always say to him, but did it happen to you? Yes, I think it did. You know, and he's not quite shaking the list off and just sitting down with a free mind. That this matters more and more to me now, so I put this in as a little bit of a ground rule today. We'll talk a lot. Let's get these maps and models clear. But let's leave them down here. Well, not quite, because we need them in the back of our minds, don't we, to help our, to give shape to our meditation. But let's not give them prominence when we actually come to do our practice. Good, I think that came over better than I've ever said it. I think you've got that one all right. Good. Just to set the goalposts then, yoga and Buddhism. Let's talk about yoga. Where does it come from? India? Yeah? Could it be purely a historical accident that it came from India? Might have started in Iceland. Might have started in New Zealand. Does it go back to the year? Does it go back to the infinity that's way, way, way back? What I'm getting at is this. We don't know, so hang loose to that idea that it's an Indian phenomenon. Yes, of course, it did take its current form in India. No doubt about that, but I think it's more universal than that. Mm. Right, is it a religion? Yeah, I know. Let's just set the goalposts. A quick stab at this. Yes, no, or whatever. No. All right, okay. Is it allied to any religion?
Some people think it is.
They do, don't they? Right. Very good. So say no more. That's good. All right. Very good. Is it all about being on the yoga mat?
No.
Ah, good, good, good. Buddhism. What's wrong with this statement? Buddhism is one of the world's major religions. So, sometimes when you try and look for a definition, it says it relates to a god.
Yeah.
But if you translate religion as a path, a way of life, then that's the other side, isn't it? That's all right. All right, we don't have to pin this one down yet. This is just the introducing the themes, if you like. Buddhism. Ism. Is that right? What's an ism? Well, it seems to me that the West makes them into isms.
Yeah.
Originally in India, where this time round Buddhism started, it's not called Buddhism. Might be nowadays, of course, because it's come universal language, but it was the Buddha Dharma. It was the Dharma, the teaching, the path taught by the Buddha. Buddhism is a Western term for it, and it bothers me a bit because that unfortunately does line it up with Hinduism, Judaism, etc., and classes it as yet another religion. And the big danger to me is that we line them all up alongside one another and look for the correspondences, and I'd rather we considered, and I'll have to use the word because everybody does, Buddhism as a separate thing. And I'll say Buddhism 100 times today, but I don't actually like it particularly. Mm. It's a bit clumsy calling it the Buddha Dharma every time, isn't it? So Buddhism will have to do. All right then, shall we move on to our main topic and talk about the yogic path? I've deliberately left all those points unanswered. Yeah? Mm-hmm. That's what we'll do as the day goes on. We've just set the ground a little bit, but now talking about yoga and Buddhism, and I'd like now to move on to the second of our eight little subject matters today and look at the yogic path. So let's go through some preliminaries. The word yoga, let's start with that. It derives from a Sanskrit word, ykayati, rukt. Not much of a word, is it? They don't go much for vowels, I don't think, in Sanskrit. But what does that, or what does the word yoga mean?
To unite, or yoke.
To yoke, or to bring together, yeah. Or to harmonise. What's being brought together? Your body and your mind, okay. Now, what I like also is to think of body and mindfulness being brought together. Mindfulness being attentiveness. Because it seems to me that yoga is about having, we'll just limit it to the mat for now, is much more, of course, as we'll see, having an experience doing yoga postures, but bringing your full attention to it. So combining yoga and mindfulness. So I like that too, but body and mind will do for now. Then we've got to look at what we mean by body and mind. It's not as obvious as it first seems. I was hoping to show you a diagram, it may come up in a minute, where we come into what you've mentioned already, the koshas. These are layers of our psychophysical being. Layers, like layers of an onion. The top layer, the outer layer, is that of our body, the anamaya kosha, our physical body. If we, like an onion, look at the deep, successively deeper layers, well, let's take them one by one. Beneath the physical body is what we sometimes call the subtle body, sometimes called the pranic body, sometimes called the energy body. And that in itself has two or three different layers. So we're getting more refined as we go deeper into these layers. Subtle body. If you are... If if you get a shock, somebody gives you a piece of bad news or something, where do you feel it? Is it a physical? It's not a physical blow, is it? It's a piece of news. It's a piece of information. So nobody's touched you physically. Nobody's done anything, but you feel it quite strongly. Okay, I would say that's your subtle body, particularly your heart centre, responding to that information. If you feel hot or cold, we're very sensitive on that subtle level. It's not just an outer physical thing. What I'm leading up to is I think this next level down is actually a very prominent one in our awareness, even if we don't acknowledge it as such. Then we go a layer deeper, still in the subtle body, and we come to the system through the body, or through the subtle body, of meridians and chakras and nadis. If you look at an acupuncturist chart of the human body, you'll see these thousands of lines, some very tiny, some quite strong, that fill the human body shape. Yeah, and acupuncture, in particular the Chinese medical system, operates using those lines, those energy pathways. The main one runs from the crown of the head to the base of the trunk and is called the Sushumna. We'll be doing some exercises later involving the Sushumna. Weaving around that main one are two subsidiary channels called Ida and Pingala. They're called something else in the Buddhist tradition, because it may surprise you that the Tibetan Buddhist tradition completely agrees with this model and in fact uses it. But we only ever hear about it in the yoga world, so there's one of my points I want to make about the crossover, but that's for later too. So you've got these two subsidiary channels, and where they cross over the main channel is where the chakra points are. Chakra, a spinning wheel, yeah. So the word means wheel, chakra. Do you ever do chakrasana? I know we tried that in class now. I think most of us have forgotten how to do it since we were kids, but it's there as a beautiful pose, potentially. So, yes, little concentrations of energy. Now, it's interesting that most people say whirling vortices or vortices of energy. One of the present-day mentors in Yin Yoga, a Japanese man called Hiroshi Motoyama, is also a clairvoyant, and he says he sees chakras, but he doesn't see them like that. So what do we believe here? Who knows? He sees them like cones with a root near the back and a flowering towards the front. So
they all have flowers, those things.
And they all do as well, that's right. Yeah. So one main channel, two subsidiaries, seven chakra points if you count the top and the bottom. So there's top, bottom and five in the middle, and we'll go into those in more detail later. Then we come to the meridians of the body, and they're linked to the organs. So we get the liver meridian, the urinary bladder meridian, etc., the kidney meridian. And acupuncturists and Chinese medicine very much deal with those. When we do yin yoga this afternoon, we'll see that some poses align with some meridians. If you want to know more about that, consult this lady, Sarah Powers, a wonderful yoga teacher. And in fact, there are diagrams in there that we could look at later that show you a yoga pose, and on them superimposed are the lines of the meridians. We haven't finished yet. There are said to be 72,000 smaller energy channels called nadis, N-A-D-I-S, spreading out through the body. How they know about 72,000, I don't know, but there it is. A lot. So, that's our subtle body. Are we talking about body or mind here? At this level? It's blurring a bit, isn't it? Interesting to me, that is. Okay, go a level deeper. And perhaps we are into what we might understand more as mind. That is to say, the more surface level of our mind, our discursive level of discursive thought, a functional, that the brain we use to fulfill our daily functions, our busy mind, that mind that you want to quieten down when you sit down to meditate, but it won't quieten down, yeah? The busy mind. Good. What's the next level down from that? Are we struggling here to relate experience to what comes next? Well, when you say, I can't keep my busy mind still, what part of you is saying that?
Conscious mind.
So a deeper, so we've got another level of mind, watching the surface mind, haven't we? Yeah. Sometimes in meditation you might be lucky enough to get those terrific moments where everything is quiet and still. There's no discursive thought, there's no other level of mind watching the discursive thought mind. There's something doing absolutely nothing, a glorious nothing. Have you ever experienced that briefly? Another level of mind. It was remarkable at a session down at Burston recently when we did some meditating, and one lady was really, really quite quick on things. She said, I've just had a real shock that in meditation you can choose where to place your attention in your mind. You can actually choose. So if you've got a busy mind and you think, well, I'll just give up, I can't quieten my mind. No, she realised, you can sort of step back in your mind and watch it. With horror, probably, at the number of constant thoughts that keep arising, the thought factory. And I think she found you can step back from that too, but you can choose to. You don't just sort of think, oh, that was lucky, wasn't it? I've just sort of found a nice quiet corner in my mind. To be honest, once we get past the rudimentary level of meditation, I think that's what we start to do.
So would you equate that fifth level with pure awareness?
No, I'd put it as pure awareness, although, as we will see, as you're borrowing the phrases there, when we look at meditation this afternoon, we can probably subdivide our experience even more than this before we get to that level. If we go back through these
koshas,
the sheaths, the layers, from gross body to subtle body to mind, to deeper mind,
And then. Yeah.
So, okay, the Hindu yoga tradition would say that deep down at the core of all this is your causal mind, which is, if you like, a permanent entity, a soul, if you like. Buddhism would say there is no such thing. So we've hit one difference there, haven't we?
And is that why you missed it out? I thought you were just going to come back to it later, but you're just saying...
I was waiting for it to come up because it's a bit of a bombshell, isn't it? So far, yes, they all match. Oh, very good.
Yeah.
No, they don't, do they? We've got something big here.
Yeah.
Which then poses another question. Is yoga a religion? Is yoga Hindu? And my provisional answer is no, it isn't. And we'll talk about that when we come to the little history bit in a few minutes.
Except that lots of the teachers teach from a Hindu perspective.
They do.
And so that's where
they
the
do.
Tradition maybe lies.
I think, what do you think? I think that in modern times, there's been a choice there. Some people have fallen in love with the whole package of yoga, India, Hindu, and it's gathered pace and become a model for people to live and practice by. Others have seen that, as I think I have, that yoga is in its own right a practice that, as we'll see from the history, actually isn't Hindu. It isn't Hindu. But a lot of people, to go back to the first model, want to make it Hindu again. They actually want all the trappings of Hinduism. So we've got a fork in the road there that we'll explore in the history section, if we may. Yeah?
So what would you say is yoga philosophy?
Well, we're anticipating something here. You had a period of the Vedas, the ancient texts, sacred texts of India, that modern Hinduism, if you like, is based on. But there was a period, roughly 500 BC, and I'm trying to say as little as possible because I want to say more later, in which there was a reaction to the Vedas. And a whole range of philosophy, the Upanishads, grew from that. That isn't Hinduism, that's a reaction to Hinduism. But as time's gone on, it's sort of gone full circle and been reincorporated as though it always was Hinduism. It wasn't, it was anti. We'll see. We'll look in detail in a minute on that. So.
That's a question.
Yeah?
Is it to do with. They talk about deities, don't they?
But maybe we need to define deities there, because you might say that in a theistic religion, I mean, they're posited as absolutes, whereas in Buddhism we're aware of ever higher levels of consciousness, mm-hmm. of beings, of light, devas, of what we might call gods with a small g, but we're not positing this creator god idea that Christianity might, Hinduism might. We're slightly redefining it therefore, aren't we?
Yeah.
Now, when we look at this afternoon, there's a little video clip, if it works, of a man called Paul Grilly. He will tell us that our mind, which of course you can't physically locate anywhere, we've already gone beyond that, haven't we? It's not in our heads. So where is our mind? Let's turn the question round. What are we talking about when we talk about our mind? Where is it? What is it? What if I were to say that your mind is in your chakras? Would that sound outrageous? Paul Grilly thinks so. And he would say that certain aspects of your mind, that in Buddhism we call samskaras, flag that, we'll look at them later, are distributed in each of the chakras according to the particular nature. Samskaras are your deep characteristics that maybe you were born with, that you brought from a previous life. Yeah? I'm flagging these up for further attention, don't worry. We'll look at them afterwards. Enough said. Look at now body-mind. I hope we blurred the distinction and began to get very interested in the relationship. Yeah? That's enough said on that one for the moment. Right, okay, got to move on. If you look back at the history of yoga and look for what you might call a root text, any ideas what the root text? Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. Can anybody tell me who or what was Patanjali?
Enigmatic.
Yes, very good word. Maybe a human being, maybe not. We'll find out perhaps a little more as we go on. In the 2nd century BC, a sutra was composed, incorporating, if you like, it was a synthesis of all that was known about yoga as of that time. Patanjali means, I think, that which has fallen from the sky, isn't it? So it's like wisdom that has descended on the earth. So that's what makes people think there was no such person as Patanjali. Maybe it's a mythical figure. What you have there, a list of 8 limbs of yoga that came out of these sutras. Let me say first of all that the word sutra, what does sutra mean?
Thread.
Thread. A thread. The Western mind posits a problem, goes through logic to work out the problem, and ends with QED, the answer. The Eastern mind posits a problem, points a finger towards the answer and doesn't complete it. Dot, dot, dot. I love that. And these sutras do precisely that. They don't give you answers, they point fingers to the answers. So, you have, in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, 196 aphorisms. An aphorism? Good words we're coming up with here, aren't we? If you look it up, it says it's a pithy saying. That's a strange description, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Shall we say there are 196 comments on different aspects of yoga that really make you think. I think they're slightly koan-like sometimes. They're not quite the full answer, but they lead you towards it. 30 or so of them give you the most precise list we can come up with. 8 limbs of yoga. And you have them there. Yama, niyama, etc. Any new words on there for anyone? Okay, well let's start at 3 and go in both directions. 3 is asana, which is posture. So when you go to a yoga class, you perform postures. So already we can see that postures are far from being the whole thing. They're just an integral part of a bigger system. Okay, in the 196 aphorisms of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, guess how many are about postures? Arguably none, but one. One says that The yogi should be able to sit with steadiness and ease. Sthira Sukha. Doesn't tell you how to. Nor does it give you all these other poses that we now practice. What do we deduce from that? That they didn't actually exist then, or what?
That they weren't that important?
They weren't that important. Really, all that was important is that you could sit with steadiness and ease, with sthira and sukha, are the same words.
Were there, rather than anything written down, were there pictures, visual interpretations of this?
When we look at the history, we might see that the word depictions of what looked like yoga poses came back even before then. I don't particularly think that the full range of yoga poses that we now see were actually developed very much then. If you then go to the Hatha Yoga Pradipika from the 13th century, you've got a few poses there. You've got about 20 or 30 poses. How many poses are there now? Hundreds, absolutely hundreds. It puts it into perspective for me then that what we're doing is not trying to achieve some superlative gymnastic feat, not trying to stretch for stretch's sake. We're trying to learn how to sit with steadiness and ease. But of course, to do that, our entire bodies have got to be free of tension. Our attention has got to be honed to be centred. And I think really that's what yoga's all about. And I think that what might appear to be an underplaying of posture is actually saying all we need to know. That's what we're aiming at. Okay, we can explore that one later. What about these other ones briefly? Yama and niyama, they might mean something different in yoga as opposed to Buddhism. Those words come up in a different way. Yama and niyama are about you and your life. And the different things that you might change to lead a life that would then lead to good physical yoga practice, deeper yoga practice, etc. Yeah? So your diet, your beliefs, the way you relate to other people, the way you relate to yourself, they're all in those first two. Then we've got asana, posture. Do anyone know what the real meaning of the word asana is? Seat. Not your bottom. What do we mean? Seat.
Sitting comfortably.
Sitting comfortably. And your inner seat?
Core.
Your core, if you like, yes. There's a place in you which is, you could relate it to those deeper levels that we talked about earlier. There's a place in you, often called your Vajra seat, by the way, but we'll come onto that word later, that is your deep centre. So in a way, your seat within. And I think that's partly what sitting comfortably is drawing you into. Pranayama, breathing practices, mostly. Through what channels do we derive prana, which is energy?
Through our nadis.
Yes, that's right. It's through all that subtle body system we described. To be vibrant and alive, we need to take in prana, retain prana. It is breathing the only way we do that.
Whatever we consume.
It is really, isn't it? So food comes into it. Even sunshine comes into it. Wholesomeness in a way. But breathing is the primary way. And when we think of pranayama, invariably we think of breath. But it isn't the whole story. So if you eat badly, you get very little from your little prana from your diet. So you would come to what's called a sattvic or a wholesome diet. Then we come to dharana, dhyana, samadhi. So if you like, we're looking at a path here from 1 to 8 that becomes increasingly refined. Dharana is one-pointedness of mind. Dhyana is a particular elevated state of mind. And samadhi, if you like, is the ultimate state of yoga, where mind and body merge as of one. So we've got quite a path there that is a long, long one from just a yoga mat practice. And that really is the main point there. So, when we come to look at Buddhism, we will find Well, Buddhism likes lists much more than the yoga tradition likes lists. So there's a Buddhist formulation that I think correlates beautifully with those eight, and we'll look at that a little bit later. Okay, enough said. Yogic path. We've outlined it, but it's all been a map or a model so far. Now we've got to get down to practice it, haven't we? So, I'd like next to go up to the yoga room.